You're listening to a classic business podcast as heard on Classic 1027. 1027.
Tourism continues to be the sector most severely impacted by COVID-19 and the government's regulations in response to curbing the spread of the virus. We're approaching the usually busy summer season here in South Africa. TERS has only been extended for a few more weeks. Borders still aren't open. Insurers have started to come to the party to some extent, but still operators are suffering. Events companies are battling to adapt. And South Africa's tourism minister, Mamaloko Kubayi-Ngubane, believes that many businesses in the sector won't survive the pandemic. But the tourism minister is also confident that gaps and opportunities will exist all along the tourism value chain that we might be able to fill when things settle down and return to normal. Now, we saw in the June supplementary budget, the department's budget allocation dropped by 1 billion rand from 2.4 to 1.4 billion rand. That's a 41% reduction with which to revive the sector. So questions around that. And it also hasn't been helped by some flip-flopping on the tourism regulations. Earlier today, we had the tourism minister telling the SABC that now intra-provincial travel for leisure is allowed. You're allowed to sleep in hotels or lodges for leisure in the province in which you live in. Well, we're joined now by Wendy Schultz, CEO of Thompson's Travel, Peter Smulik, owner of Far and Wide Tours, and Corne Koch, who is head of a convention bureau at Cape Town and Western Cape Convention Bureau, which is a division of Westgro. Wendy, I understand that obviously there's a lot of lobbying going on and meetings with government are being held, but let's just set the scene here from your perspective. I mean, Thompson Travel, one of the most well-known holiday and travel agencies in the market. Just give us a feel for how you are navigating the COVID-19 storm.
COVID-19 has certainly really affected the tourism industry and us as a travel company. Everything's come to a grinding halt. We've had numerous cancellations, a lot of people that are nervous, they're not wanting to travel, they're wary to travel overseas. Also, the pricing has been affected, and should people need to go overseas at the moment, they can only do it on repatriation flights on a one-way basis. If they qualify to do those repatriation flights, and those flights are fairly pricey. So COVID has had a major effect on the industry, with hotels closing, a lot of agencies closing, and tour operators being affected, as well as a huge amount of people being unemployed. So it's been very hard on the industry, and we've seen a lot of people being affected by huge retrenchments within the sector.
And if we look at government support, I know a couple of months back the tourism department announced a 350 million rand relief package. Was that helpful in any way?
I did think it was helpful in the beginning, with the TERS allowing some employers to keep a certain level of employment. Unfortunately, with the ongoing borders being closed, a lot of companies haven't been able to sustain it, even with the government intervention. And unfortunately, this has resulted in retrenchments within the sector.
Now, Corne, coming to South Africa's meetings, incentives, conventions and exhibition industry, the MICE, as it's known, it's another very important sector, specifically around attracting foreign visitors and investment. I see last year 11.4% of foreign tourism was actually attributed to the MICE industry, where about 1 million business delegates are hosted annually, and Cape Town really the centre of that. What sort of growth had you been witnessing prior to COVID?
Yes, I think prior to COVID, if we talk about just sort of general figures, we've actually performed quite well specifically in the Western Cape in tourism numbers from year on year. As you know, the year before was drought, and we always have these challenges in South Africa, which makes it the barriers to entry even more. So we've actually seen growth from 2018 to 2019 in terms of arrivals to South Africa as in general, which is 1.7 million arrivals in 2018 and 2 million in 2019. So there was a significant growth that started in South Africa, and actually the figures I've just mentioned was for the Western Cape. And of course, the arrivals of your business events sector is part of that. So there has been growth, and the The sector here is obviously quite prone to receiving international visitors into the Western Cape. So you, if you looked at the job creation and if you look at bed nights sold and foreign direct investment, it is obviously a huge loss to not be able to realize that. And to Wendy's point, you know, the opportunities that's gone lost, we don't even have to talk about that. It's, we know that, because you would also notice that there's about, you know, everybody, there's a big value chain in tourism. And that's, I think, the important issue to highlight, is the fact that you just don't sell a bed night, but you have a restaurant owner and you have the attraction and you have the tour operator. So the value chain is really large. And even in the MICE sector, or the sector for business events, you have exhibition organizers, event planners, people who build exhibition stands, designers, caterers. So it's a huge value chain that's it's impacted.
And a value chain, Cornet, just to set the scene with the growth of the industry, that showed promise and potential for a country that's been looking for ways to get growing again and growing again, because we entered the pandemic with such a weak economy as it was. The MICE subsector of the tourism industry was a standout, and certainly one that was promising. Then COVID happened, and obviously we know international borders shut. But the big question now for government surely should be, how do we support the MICE industry? If it's shown that potential in the past, as we're looking for levers to pull to get South Africa growing again, we need to come to the party and help support an industry that has been globally competitive. What could we possibly be doing right now to better support the MICE industry to bounce back from COVID?
Sure, I think that so the beauty of meetings are that meetings definitely brings the bed nights and the hospitality sector. We understand that the meeting sector can be an advantage on economic recovery. You're absolutely right. At the moment, you know that we are only allowed to have meetings, not more than 50 people. And it's not really a significant number to help, you know, to start economics or to start an economy or to, for an event planner or even a meeting venue to actually, you know, make the money. So we do need, the lobbying at the moment is to ask, can we not host a bigger amount of delegates in a venue? The industry is showing, like the hospitality sector, they can open safely. We can follow the guidelines. The industry is very used to being regulated. So another layer of regulation to, obviously, in terms of the health and safety standards, is not difficult for the sector to adapt to. And if we can look into that, your domestic market will be the market that will obviously start. So if the support and that's why it's important to open the tourism sector, because although business travel is allowed, your corporate companies are still not really allowing their staff to travel, because it is a risk, you know. And so we do need that, it's that confidence. I think Wendy spoke about it just now. It's the trust that we have to build, and we have to make sure that people are comfortable to travel, because we've all been boxed in for the last 5 months. So we need to have that confidence that it is okay and I will be all right to go and visit and to sleep in a hotel or even to visit a conference center. So that's the kind of marketing that needs to be done, and also from product. But the industry is really ready. I think my fellow panelists here will agree with me. You know, all of us will make sure that a client is looked after and that we follow the guidelines. And in South Africa, we align very well with the international guidelines. So we have to start somewhere. So you have to show that in terms of allowing a traveler or a visitor in your venue or in an event.
That's always been my concern, Cornet, as we look at the aggregate demand dropping off because of this fear amongst consumers and travelers. I think even if you lifted all the restrictions and regulations tomorrow, the battle and the struggle would still be to stimulate that aggregate demand and build confidence. And so we're seeing other markets easing and lifting restrictions, very mindful, for example, in the UK, that they have to now focus on boosting aggregate demand to support their restaurants and subsidising British patrons to go out and eat to some extent by dropping VAT and that kind of thing. Yet we still have the handbrake on. Peter, we've spoken quite a lot on the show about restaurants and hotels being impacted. What about tour operators? Because there are literally thousands in the country, from the very big ones like Hilton Ross and Springbok Atlas.
You ended your question with the big ones like Hilton Ross and Springbok Atlas. And we are one of the very small ones. And our bus, for instance, is on blocks. Luckily, we don't have to pay our transport insurance, but we've paid our license fees and all that. So that is down the drain. But the main thing now is, if we could, like you indicated earlier, at least do interprovincial travel, we could possibly start with flower tours to the Makwaland in August for the South African tourists. That is a starting point. Although we are basically operating with German tourists, foreigners generally, and our season starts in August with Namakwaland, and that is, of course, at this stage a no-go zone for many reasons.
For many reasons. Just talk to me about what you pay for license fees as small operators, because obviously there was a grace period for the renewal of license discs to the 31st of August under the Disaster Management Act regulations, but that doesn't really assist the commercial transport sector very much.
No, well, it's a few thousand bucks. I can't tell you the exact figure what we pay. Luckily, we only have to pay it every 5 years. And then, of course, the annual normal licensing fee, which is just over 1,000 per bus. But, you know, the main thing is that we have zero income. We have those of us who still pay off vehicles, they have to pay, keep paying their vehicles, their installments. And most of our vehicles in the industry are probably still financed because they got to be relatively new. You can't have a vehicle that's 10 years old and take foreign tourists around. That's just not on.
You mentioned the fact that at least interprovincial travel would help you pivot to some extent towards more local tourism, because as I understand it, tour operators are really geared towards the foreign inbound tourist. What likelihood is there of many of these businesses remaining in operation without such intervention of reopening interprovincial travel before the year is up?
Well, I think many have already closed, many will close. We are fortunate, we are small enough. We've got financial backup that keeps us alive, but we're not progressing. We've done very well over the last 5 years. German tourists in particular have been coming more and more, and they will be coming again once borders are open and aeroplanes are flying, but that remains to be seen when that will be allowed.
I think another important issue for the industry to address, Wendy, would be cancellation fees, because there are processes such as fit-to-travel certificates and COVID-19 screening just before you board a flight, and that make it pretty impossible to predict the arrival of every single client, and hence the charging of even short notice cancellation fees becomes an impossibility. So how should cancellation fees be approached at a time when there is such uncertainty, and you also want to stimulate bookings when we do allow interprovincial and also international travel to begin again? Because I know I certainly won't book without 100% money back guarantee in this environment.
Well, usually our clients, they fly, have insurance. So if anything goes wrong, they claim from insurance. If you have to cancel at the last minute, then cancellation fees, whatever they might have to pay, then is covered by their own insurance. That's a must.
Unfortunately, Peter, having just experienced this with a school tour that was cancelled, it's not quite as simple as that. Very often, if you have insurance through an operator, they've first got to get the refunds from the airlines and the other service providers in the value chain. And so you end up waiting and waiting and waiting. And in our case, probably got out about 70 cents in the rand from the booking. It's an issue that the industry has to deal with. Wendy, to come in here from Thomson Tours perspective, how can cancellation fees be handled at a time like this, which is pretty much unprecedented?
It is a little bit of an issue because in travel insurance, there is a cancel for any reason benefit with some of the travel insurance companies, which if you, when purchasing your package, you buy the travel insurance within 24 hours of purchasing the package, you can get cancelled for any reason benefit. However, this only covers 50% of the cancellation charges and not the full 100%. What we are trying to do going forward is to try and have flexible booking policies and flexible cancellation policies. It's not that we would be able to always offer 100% refunds, because unfortunately we're still bound to our suppliers' rules, which means that if you're booking the cheapest airfares, you would have a cancellation on that airfare. You would be able to change the airfare, and the airlines have been pretty flexible in terms of changing your reservation to a later date and providing travel vouchers, which in some cases are valid for up to 2 years, which gives you great flexibility and also the opportunity to travel at a later stage. There's a lot more involved than just being able to give 100% your booking back. Because obviously there's consultants involved, suppliers involved, work involved. So going forward, we're looking at different ways that we can have flexible packages where the suppliers, the hotels, the airlines come to the party to offer to offer this flexibility. But that obviously does impact these suppliers, which means that they might have a cancellation where they had X amount of rooms booked for, let's say 10 rooms booked for tonight, and you cancel today, and they don't have the opportunity to resell those bookings. So they might let you move the booking, so they obviously the revenue's not lost. But if you cancel at a last minute stage like that, they will often charge a cancellation charge.
I understand the complexities in normal business operating environments. What I'm saying is, for an abnormal business operating environment like COVID, surely one has to start looking at waiving cancellation fees to start stimulating that aggregate demand again. Because not many travelers would travel with any comfort in an environment where there is so much uncertainty, where potentially government may roll back if I want to book into the summer season, and we have a second wave and we have another ministerial declaration that everything is closed. What happens then, for example?
Well, as I said, most of the suppliers have been quite accommodating, that they've actually allowed for movement, so you can postpone your booking with up to 2 years to use that booking, or they've charged very minimal cancellation charges, and you have been able to, on international bookings, claim for those differences in cancellation charges through your travel insurance. So a lot of the hotels, a lot of the airlines still have a COVID policy in place. Some of the COVID policies are right up until December. So it does offer you flexibility, and a lot of them have been very accommodating with the cancellation charges, but it's not across the board. Negotiating forward, we would like to negotiate where we have flexible rates, where you are able to cancel at the last minute without incurring costs.
Cornet, to come back to the eventing and conferencing industry, I'm doing a lot of webinars at the moment. They come with their pros and cons. It's just not the same as a live event. You don't have the energy as a speaker, as a facilitator. On the other side, the pros are that there does seem to be a lot of engagement. It's a lot more measurable through some of the technology as well. So it's a bit of a mixed bag. What impact do you see video conferencing and that technology having longer term on events and conferencing in the country?
Yes, I think that's a really good question, and it's something that the sector is dealing with, because they have to adapt their event design, you know, to accommodate that. So we do know for survival right now, we'll have to use the virtual model. But that is also starting to morph to the hybrid model, where you have a virtual component together with your face-to-face meeting. And the sector locally as well as internationally is saying that will probably stay for quite a long time, maybe over, you know, like a year out, where you will have both of those take place, because people are adapting and people realize that, oh, I can actually now attend a conference running in Copenhagen, where in the past I didn't have money to travel, or my company didn't want to pay for me to attend the conference. So you have the good and the bad together. The challenge is that how do you monetize that for your event company? You know, how do the conference organizer or even the event a professional, whether it be a festival or another event, how do we then get people to participate in the virtual space and have a quality experience? So your, like I've mentioned just now, the architecture of that and how do you engage with the delegates, that's going to be important. But the sector is also knowing that it won't stay for a long time. Because we are humans, we do need that contact. We all know that, you know, the minute the lockdown level 5 in South Africa was lifted, it was so nice just to walk in the street, although everybody was like on the promenade in Sea Point to do their exercise. You yearned for that touch and that personal kind, or rather interpersonal, you know, just to be with people. So that will hopefully be the saving of the industry, but it will take a long while for us to get to that level, just purely because we now are getting used to doing things online or in a different level. And that is why, with the value of what meetings brings to destinations and economies, it is something that the sector, both here and internationally, is very adamant of carrying through the message of the meanings of business events. You know, we all need to meet. There's a lot of innovation that's starting to take place. We need to restore relationships. We need to look at new investments into economies, and meetings are the conduit for that. So because of that meaning, we will hopefully see face-to-face value come back for meetings. And of course, they support the visitor economy, because then eventually if people then meet, they'll go to the restaurant, there will be pre and post tours for during conferencing. So there's a big drive from the industry to make sure that events can still take place. They might not be right now. There will be phases of those.
And many visitors come back after, say, visiting a mining indaba, which is one of the big events in February. Chatting to delegates at mining indaba, very often the delegates return with their families and go on a safari, and the multipliers are absolutely huge. Wendy, when we look at the future, what do you see as the keys that are going to drive and influence and motivate travel decision-making post-COVID-19? I'm sure space is going to be one of the big issues, that travelers are going to look for wide open spaces. And that's something that we have in abundance. Should we start now thinking about marketing South Africa far more aggressively, and also in line with that, start agitating more intently for visa reforms, which have been so long in the making? But I believe the e-visa issue is still not resolved. I mean, the fact that we haven't used the last 5 months to get that up and running just boggles the mind. But how do you see it playing out?
Look, I do believe that people will want to go to properties like Bushman's Kloof, where you've got wide open spaces, you've got the opportunity to go on nature walks and get out into the open, where there is less people within the resorts, less people in the hotels. I do think that that will be part of tourism going forward. But a lot of people like to travel, and they like to go to restaurants and have a bit of atmosphere and have a bit of a vibe when they're traveling. They like to walk the streets of Europe to look at all the different shops and street cafes. And I think that will come back eventually. Maybe in the interim, a lot more people would be a bit conservative. So if they were doing a tour, for example, they would want less people on the bus and not as many people on the buses with them. So restrict the number of people that you have on a touring bus. And also, I think going forward at sites where you used to queue to go into sites, they would need to come up with better ideas on how to actually have a bit more social distancing and have less people going into a site on any particular day. So the way of travel will change. I do believe that the industry is very ready for travel at the moment. I believe South Africa is really good in terms of what they've proposed to the government in order for us to open up travel. The hotels have put in all the protocols needed. They're adhering to these protocols. So I think that tourism in South Africa can be opened up quite easily. I do believe the consumers and the customers for future travel will travel slightly differently. There might be more self-drives instead of coach tours. There might be different options or different ways people are going to travel, but I certainly do believe people will want to travel again. And eventually it will become the new normal. We've seen with bird flu, swine flu, all the different diseases and issues we've had before, we've overcome these, and I do believe that going forward, we will be able to travel. It might be slightly different. You might have to wear a mask on a plane, but we're very adaptable and people want to travel. So as long as they can see the hotels, the airlines are actually following the protocols, I do believe that the consumers will start to feel very comfortable with the new protocols and will want to travel.
Absolutely. It's been incredibly tough. It still is just a fight for survival, I think. But those that do survive it through to the other side, I think will be extraordinarily well positioned to take advantage of that new normal that you speak of. Wendy Schultz, CEO of Thompsons for Travel, Peter Smullick, owner of Far and Wide Tours, and Corné Koch, head of Convention Bureau at Cape Town and Western Cape Convention Bureau, which is a division of Westgrowth. Thanks so much for your time and sharing your insights into the ongoing struggles in the tourism and hospitality sector. That's it for the show tonight. Thanks to sound engineer Matabataba Radebe and producer Andres Mahlangu. I'm going to leave you in the hands of Maestro Richard Koch in Johannesburg, and San Mohammed is in the Jazz Lounge in Cape Town. Good night.